The last time we spoke with Mark Burke, it was on local constituency matters. There were 34,000 people who watched that video. So clearly, people want to know what he's got to say. And today, he's talking in his new role as the DA's spokesperson on finance, and in particular, the Transnet story. Mark, nice to see you. That looks like an office at Parliament, or do you just have an office like that at home?
It's my new office in Parliament, decidedly more traditional than the constituency office in Oudtshoorn.
Right. What's happened in Oudtshoorn? Is that all settled down now to the degree that you can be promoted? Because I presume that is what has happened to you.
Well, I would hope that my parliamentary work stands somewhat separate to my constituency work, but to answer the question on what's happening in that constituency, I'm afraid to report that, you know, the ANC, while having given the mayoral chains to a Freedom Front councillor, has installed an ANC loyal to the municipal manager position, and gradually, as expected, service delivery is declining in Oudtshoorn. But we are not standing back, and by the local government elections in 2026, we fully intend to retake the town and prioritize the citizens there.
It's such an interesting political scenario that we have at the moment in the government of national unity. The DA's, I was informed recently, is John Steenhuisen is no longer the leader of the opposition because he's part of the government. And well, the leader of the opposition presumably is now MK, whatever that might mean. But from your perspective, that doesn't mean that the DA must sit idly by and allow the 40% party, the ANC, just to do what it wants.
Absolutely. And I always tell my colleagues here that the ANC, in fact, has 159 out of 400 seats in Parliament, which more closely equates to 39% of the parliamentary representation than 40%. The fact of the matter is the ideology that has gotten us to this point, especially over the last 15 years, has failed the South African economy. This is a rocket ship waiting for fuel, and we keep pumping in Soviet-style gas that makes the engine implode instead of making us move forward. So there's a real difficulty. If our ideas are not heard in the government of national unity, then we effectively become a bystander or even a participant in what they deem the national democratic revolution, something we never signed up for, something that we know has disastrous consequences for the economy. And so unless our ideas are heard, we have to consider what the options at our disposal are. But we are still hopeful, and I myself am an optimist, that in fact, some of these market-friendly concepts will be implemented. And one of the biggest ones there is Transnet, which is a massive brake on our economy.
So Transnet's incompetence really began, well, I don't know when it began, a long time ago, I presume, but its implosion began with the Guptas. And it's very interesting when you track the whole state capture story. Anosh Singh and the Guptas started, Brian Molefe, they started with Transnet. They'd made their malevolent choices there. They started plundering Transnet first. And it's almost once they had perfected that they moved on to Eskom and found an even bigger booty. But Transnet's inability to service the South African exporters has really cost this country dearly. And now the ANC wants to, as it did with Eskom, bail out Transnet. Now, the Eskom bailout has worked. The Transnet bailout presumably would have a similar impact, or at least there would be those who would believe so.
Well, I think that the definition of has worked is open for interpretation, in that our lights have been on for more than 300 days. We're grateful for that. The cost per kilowatt hour produced is mind-boggling in South Africa at the moment. And the number of employees for kilowatt hour produced is disproportionate to anywhere else in the world. So it's worked in that we've chucked a bunch of money at a problem, and for the time being, the lights are on. But it's not worked in terms of making government more efficient and procuring at more preferential terms than anybody else in South Africa. You know, international experts are telling us we pay two or three times the market rates for anything we procure in South Africa. And we keep chucking money, by the way, that we don't have. there's one source for public money, and that's public taxpayers. And so, yes, our lights are on at Eskom, but we have to ask ourselves, is that an efficient cost? Now, onto the problem of Transnet, there's this concept in business called bike shedding, which is if you are building a nuclear reactor, the process of conceptualizing the design and, consulting with folks on how that should look is so complex that folks check out and everybody starts chatting for 2 hours about the bike shed being built for employees right next to the nuclear reactor. And because that's at least something they can conceptualize. Now, to your point of Brian Malefe and co, this is exactly what happened. Transnet is such a complex beast that these folks were able to steal there because most people check out of the complexity of a super entity that should really be 40 separate entities. Each of them run efficiently where it makes sense for the public sector to own it. That's fine. But for the most part, the private sector should be running these entities. And so that has to be a precondition for any further support and can't look like a bailout. It at best can look like bridging finance to get us to that point.
But how are you going to get that message through?
Well, the fact of the matter is we all jointly promised in our midterm budget statement at the end of last year, and I count the Minister of Finance in there, an ANC minister, our Deputy Minister and Finance, and so forth. We all promised there will be no further bailouts. The fiscus cannot afford it. We're at a point now where South Africa's debt-to-GDP ratio is 75%. Now, 15 years ago when I was a student, I looked at these numbers and we were in the mid-20s, and I was pretty excited to live in a country where elsewhere in the world these numbers were skyrocketing. But over, a decade and a half, we've just kept swiping the credit card to insane levels at the moment, where the biggest line item on our national budget is the servicing of that debt. So the only way that we could, facilitate another bailout, which is unfathomable to the DA, is to go ahead and borrow some more, for which the interest payments will increase at a time when we can't even afford enough teachers in our schools. These things are inconceivable.
Mark, it's an interesting point you make there about the debt to GDP ratio of 75%. And I know that the Treasury have been using this as a very useful weapon in their view to say, well, other parts of the world, other countries in the world have much higher debt to GDP ratios. However, it's not long ago that there was a rebasement of the size of the South African economy, which brought that debt to GDP ratio down. So if you're comparing like with like, it's actually much higher than 75%. It's now almost approaching 90%. And it is a little bit like smoke and mirrors. The real bottom line is surely the point that you've made, that around 20 cents in every rand in tax that is taken from South African citizens and South African companies goes to pay for debt. And that, the way, if we're going to be borrowing more, means that we're going to go up to 21, 22, 23 cents, and who knows where that might end. So I guess that's also a very important point to make. But the bailout that has been proposed, how exactly would you have or what is your alternative to it?
Yeah, there's a real difficulty, just to briefly touch on the debt to GDP ratio. The fact of the matter is we have not got a diversified economy sufficient to service that level of debt. And that, by all indications, our economy is becoming less diversified over time, not more. So there might be countries that has a slightly higher debt to GDP ratio, but a massively diversified economy and often a sovereign wealth fund to go with such a high debt to GDP ratio, something we don't have. The challenge at Transnet, as with other state-owned enterprises, is these entities are so large and nebulous that it is literally the equivalent of giving money to an alcoholic because they just need one more drink to fix their state of mind. There's no sense at the moment giving money to an entity that is losing, half a billion rand at least month on month. It's perhaps worth quickly just looking at Transnet's current financial situation and then talking about what will be needed for the private sector to be able to offer services on Transnet's rail network. Now, I don't know if you're able to pull up a graph I shared just before this call, but even in the absence of that graph, the reality for Transnet at the moment is that it is able to service its interest payments and pay its employees more or less on the money coming into that business. However, it's not able to cover the cost of its maintenance, never mind the infrastructure upgrades that's needed. So the estimations at the moment are that at least 50 billion rand is needed for the infrastructure upgrades that allows the private sector to operate on portions of the rail network and, you know, engage with the ports and so forth. The 50 billion rand has to come from somewhere. But Transnet sits with this patent problem that for a long time now, especially during the Gupta era, there was so much corruption that the assets that should exist don't come close to the liabilities that do exist on the books. And so when you get to a point where you're able to take the whole monolith entity and break it down into subsidiaries, which can either be publicly owned, privately owned, or some combination, those subsidiaries will say, but there's no way I'm assuming that portion of debt without the accompanying asset. And I know what this asset is worth. One of the challenges, even to try and get to that point, is that Transnet has so far failed to do a proper asset registry, to do a portfolio analysis of what those assets combined with its people and its processes could viably be worth. And we suspect the reason they haven't done that is because they know the liabilities far exceed the assets. Now, if you can only pay your staff and you can only pay interest, but you can't do maintenance, never mind upgrades, it's the equivalent of trying to let out a house to somebody that's completely unlivable. Nobody would be willing to pay you rent to live in. And even if they were willing to pay you rent, they wouldn't be able to pay you for the next 10 years up front. So we've got these problems at Transnet. There's a line in the sand for the DA which says no more bailouts. This was our joint promise in the Government of National Unity. But they will need financing to get to the point where these subsidiary entities are able to operate profitably and independently. And so this is the difficulty we're faced with.
And those subsidiaries, is it a similar situation to what's happening at Eskom, where there is, after much resistance from the central command economy type thinking ideology, there is now going to be a breakdown of Eskom into at least three entities? Are we seeing something similar at Transnet?
Well, we need to see something similar at Transnet and more aggressive. The reality is when SAA failed, there were private airlines willing to compete. And when Eskom failed, you know, folks were able to install solar panels. But there's no real alternative to the massive amount of freight we need to move across Transnet for our exports to function. So we will need this breakup of entities, but there's no alternative in the interim. And so the situation we're now facing is with this loss-making position where maintenance and infrastructure investments are not happening, is the longer we prolong the problem in a loss-making entity, the bigger the financial support will be needed to get it to that. But to answer your question in a more simple way, perhaps, Eskom had to be broken up into three entities. Transnet probably needs to be broken up into 30 or 40 entities. And so you can just, from those numbers, try and understand the scale of the problem that we're facing.
And is there any glimmer of hope that that could occur? And I what I'm bringing in here is a private sector approach towards it and using one of the most lauded professional managers, Jack Welch at General Electric. He said there were three things that he considered when he looked at one of the subsidiaries of that company while he was fixing it. The first is, can it be fixed? Can it be sold? Or can it be closed? And one of those three options were then addressed. In this case, is that something that you would propose gets implemented when, as Transnet starts looking at how it's going to break itself down into more efficient units?
Absolutely, and it'll be a combination of all three of Jack Welch's suggestions. There are things that we cannot close, you know, so the core rail network will probably still belong to the state and will have to be leased out on a usage basis. There are other things that can absolutely be fixed. There's already talk, and to answer your question of a glimmer of hope and back to my point about being an optimist, you know, there is the glimmer that Richards Bay, the port terminal will be moving closer to being run privately. And so there are these indications. Our concern is that the pace of those reforms and the appetite for those reforms are still based on this centralist thinking ideology, whereas we need to devolve and privatize these functions as soon as possible. But that will look like fixing it. And then, as you say, some of these things will look like selling it. Now, there's this risk, and it's not a completely unfounded concern, that we immediately privatize all the portions of our rail and it still doesn't run efficiently. But the fact of the matter is there's a port in Mozambique which is privately run through which a lot of our traffic is flowing at the moment, which means it has to leave our border, go through Mozambique, get onto a ship there, simply because a privately run port there is better run than a state-owned port in South Africa. So we will have to combine, you know, fixing, selling, or closing. I'm hoping that there'll be minimal closures, but I'm also hoping that in this process, the entity will run far more efficiently. If we just move away from the fiscal cost of Transnet as it stands at the moment, the really big problem here is the economic cost of Transnet not moving things nearly as fast as it should. There's infinite demand for the coal that we're producing, but we're not able to clear it out to India as quickly as it's being produced, and that is all related to the bottlenecks on our freight and rail network.
It's quite extraordinary, really, when you make the point about Mozambique, where the harbour is run by a South African company, by Grindrod. The products have to get there by truck, which is so, so less efficient than a good rail network. And yet, exporters are sending it through those trucks, and people who live in Mpumalanga know those trucks very well, and it's messing up the roads, etc., and very difficult to get from point A to point B as a result of the arteries being clogged up. But they are able to do that and ensure it's more efficient than using one of the South African harbors, and that's quite a wake-up call. But there's many wake-up calls, Mark. I was in Davos last week, as was your colleague John Steenhuisen and a couple of other cabinet ministers from the DA. And there we saw Javier Milei from Argentina, who has taken a chainsaw to things like Transnet, being applauded because in 1 year, what has been achieved is near miraculous. We also saw Donald Trump saying, you do business with us either by being based in America or paying tariffs. That's the way it is. And by the way, we're going to cut the corporate tax rate from 21 to 15% to make companies in America even more efficient in competing with other parts of the world. And yet we in South Africa appear to be based on what was going on 2-3 years ago and just keep on kicking the can down the road. You're relatively young, certainly a lot younger than our president and many of the cabinet ministers. What are younger people of your age, or even younger than that, thinking about this situation that we're in South Africa, where we do tend to choose a road less traveled and one that does seem to be going nowhere economically anyway?
And it doesn't have to be this way. I maintain that South Africa is a super exciting place to live in. It's got so much potential. So when I speak to people who, you know, there are now some new peers with me in Parliament, and the DA has done well to bring in a lot of young guns in this last cycle. But when I speak to my peers in business, the folks that are still here are excited, but they're also frustrated in that some of these policies just make no sense. So we are excited when we look at international developments that looks like deregulation where it makes sense to. I mean, you mentioned Malay, and one of the most sensible things I've heard him say is, for every new regulation his administration introduces, they will insist on two others being stripped of equal stature. So they will not pass a new law unless somebody can come up with two others going away that are as important as the law that they're passing. I think that's a healthy way of keeping laws updated. I think people don't realize this, but often regulation is so dated that the folks who came up with it aren't even there to provide context on it anymore, but we still adhere to it. And I mean, no business would operate under those principles. The folks that I engage with are optimistic about being here, about the future. We're energetic about changing it. And just to briefly touch on the Mozambique example you mentioned earlier, of course, you didn't mention that that's also a nation in conflict at the moment. So the private sector is looking at our ports and then looking at traveling on road with truck through a country in conflict to a private port and saying that's more attractive. One way of looking at that is to become really depressed as a young person, energetic and excited about the future. Another way of looking at that is saying that is a massive market opportunity. If it is so inefficient at the moment that somebody is willing to do that trade, imagine what we can do by introducing some efficiency here, how many opportunities we can create for people and get South Africa to a place where in the first 10 years of our democracy, the world was super excited about this. I think Argentina is now transitioning into that space. And I am deeply optimistic that we will get back there again. But it does require the ANC to take its head out of the socialist sand and look into the future and look at where the opportunities are and listen to some good ideas that are being proposed in good faith, not to destroy jobs, but to create them.
What's it going to take for that to happen?
Well, I think there needs to be a willingness from our counterparty in this relationship to listen to us. It's been my short experience here that we need to create a space where folks feel like they're emotionally safe to differ from each other. But it's also been my experience for 35 years as a South African that you cannot deviate from what you think is the truth, what you think is good, because that makes people feel a bit more safe. So we can be careful around the packaging. But the sentiments here are that the market will find a good solution to our problems. The state shouldn't be trying to plan it. And if the counterparty to us in this relationship keeps relying on outdated dogma that is making South Africans poorer year on year, then we will all be failing in our joint mission, which is, can be summarized in one line. We need to grow the economy equitably. And if we're not able to do that, then there's no point in the DA cheering on the ANC's outdated ideas of how an economy is meant to function for the benefit of a few.
And the rocket fuel that you referenced earlier in this discussion, that is all that's required to get this rocket called South Africa running ahead. What is that? What is that rocket fuel?
I mean, we've got agricultural products in the port of Cape Town, which is now the worst port in the world. Jordan Neil Lewis spoke at the Cape Town Press Club last week, and he mentioned that he was in the US at the Harvard Kennedy School of Business for a course there, and he met the mayor from Long Beach in California. And at that time, when he was at this conference, he said to the mayor, "I recognize the name. You guys are the one port in the world that's worse than us." The mayor didn't believe him. He pulled up the data and he showed it to him. And Jordan had to report last week that, in fact, we have now regressed and we are, in fact, the worst port in the world. So, but all these agri products are expiring in the port. And that's not, you know, counting the cold storage cost, the downstream effects of those agri jobs lost because we're producing but we can't ship quick enough. It's not counting the counterparty relationship, the massive investment that has to go into finding markets for these products, promising delivery on a certain date and then being late. All of these things combined are such simple fixes and will let the economy grow. Now, I don't want to be a typical politician and give you the scariest number possible of how much we're losing out on. But a 2022 study indicated that, you know, the economy is losing out on about 400 billion rand a year as a result of Transnet alone. Now, that number is up for debate. I think to a large extent, it is economic speculation. But we can all agree that if we're operating at 50 or 60% in best case of our rail capacity, and we are producing these products and the world wants these products, then there's a massive economic gain to be had from fixing these small things. But we can't think of Transnet as an entity that's meant to somehow perpetuate socialist dogma.
Mark Burke is the DA spokesman on finance. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.